Hi everyone, welcome to the 209th episode of the Atlas Society Ask. My name is Lawrence DeLevo, Senior Project Manager for the Atlas Society, the leading nonprofit organization introducing young people to the ideas of Ayn Rand in creative ways like animated videos and graphic novels. Our CEO, Jennifer Grossman, is out this week, but I am excited to have join me Atlas Society Senior Scholar and Professor of Philosophy at Rockford University, Stephen Hicks. And I want to remind all of you watching this on Zoom, Instagram, X, Facebook, LinkedIn, or YouTube, you can use the comment section to type in your questions for today. We'll try to get to as many as we can closer to the end of the webinar. To start things off, just a quick introduction saying that on November 19th, 2023, Javier Milei won Argentina's presidential runoff vote, promising a dramatic shakeup in moving government policy towards a libertarian ideal to combat inflation and rising poverty. It's been 6 months since then, so Stephen is here to join us to talk about this and see just a general analysis of what's going on there. So, Stephen, thank you for joining us today.
All right, thanks for hosting, Lawrence. Yes, as Lawrence mentioned, right at the end of 2023, the world was surprised, and Argentina was surprised that an outsider, Javier Milei, had won the presidency. He had seemingly come out of nowhere and shot up in the poll, shot up in public attention. And in a hotly contested presidential race, right, won. Shortly after that, here at Atlas Society, I teamed up with economist Dr. Richard Salzman, and we did an analysis of what we knew then about the situation in Argentina, what we knew about Javier Milei in particular, and what we thought were both very promising, but then at the same time, some things that were possibly to be concerned about. So now that Milei has been in power for 6 months, I wanted to revisit Argentina, not in person this time, but intellectually and as an outside observer, to give my assessment of how the first 6 months had gone. Now, at that point, what we knew about Javier Milei was that he had significant number of libertarian views, particularly on economic issues, although those were mixed in with some conservative views. And a big part of the surprise in at the end of 2023 was that a candidate like him could have been not only prominent but one in Latin America, right, of all places in the world. Why Argentina? And in large part, it had to do with the fact that things had gotten so bad under the preceding regime that had been in power for decades that many people were willing to try something or almost anything different. Javier Milei had also gotten a significant amount of international attention, particularly from the economically minded, because while Argentina really should be a rich country. A century ago, before the Peronists had acquired power, Argentina was among the top richest countries in the world, but it had underperformed and declined significantly over the course of the 20th century, with terrible inflation, terrible budget, and just often defaulting on a fairly frequent basis. So maybe this guy who has some knowledge of actual economics and free market economics can turn some of those things around. Another surprising things about Milei's victory at that time was the number of Argentinians who had become engaged with the political process. Partly it had to do with his personal style, kind of often wild, but certainly offbeat, and he had a kind of charisma. And so even younger people who are notoriously apathetic with respect to political issues had become engaged. And what Milei among the voters was able to put together was a number of people. There have been institutions, free market, more classically liberal organizations in Argentina working for some sort of change over the course of many years. So there was a significant minority contingent of people there, but also a large number of people for whom things had just gotten so bad in Argentina that they were willing to give almost anything a try, particularly someone who seemed to have a clear voice and a clear vision for where things were going. Now, 6 months ago, the four questions that were on our mind, my mind and Professor Salzman's mind, was we know one of the problems is that politicians, candidates can often talk a good game. So was Milei really committed to doing what was necessary in Argentina, or was he running, this is putting it too flip, but for fun, that he didn't really have the seriousness of purpose and the willingness to do what is necessary to get the job done. So how really committed was he? He was a relative newcomer to practical politics and an outsider. Would he be able to overcome the political opposition, not only inside the coalition, among, so to speak, strong free market libertarian types, that was only part of the coalition that Milei had to put together. He had to work with members of other parties and other persuasions, some of them much more conservative. Would that coalition internally survive, or would he fall victim to often what happens internally? The knives come out, or any sense of weakness, and the person gets deposed. But then, more formidably, outside of the coalition, the entrenched bureaucracy, the still significant number of people in the legislature and in the judiciary who are just ideologically, and in part because their careers depend on a paycheck from the government, absolutely opposed to everything that Milei stood for. And these are formidable, entrenched opposition. Would Milei be able to prevail against them? Would he be competent enough, given his lack of administrative experience? Would he be able to learn fast enough how to organize the government and how to do the politicking necessary to get things done? And then a fourth question, and this one was even perhaps more of a concern, had to do with his character and his style. Because in the many years leading up to his winning the presidency, he was in many respects a pit bull and a fighter on internet forums and in personal conversations when he was on TV. An often savage style of speaking and a savage style of acting with respect to people, just outright name calling, often to the point of character assassination and so on. So does he have the character that's going to be necessary to handle the stresses of the office? And the office of any CEO or president carries with it enormous pressure. Anybody who has character weaknesses, those always come out. And then, of course, we want presidents to have a certain presidential style to represent the country in a certain way, to represent the government in a certain way. Does Javier Milei have that? And there were, I think, some legitimate questions there. So that's where things stood 6 months ago. And at that point, I started a list because I'm an academic, and so I wanted to put just on the record the list that I started. I commend this for anybody who's interested in doing serious evaluations. Often people are just creatures of their political party, and so they don't give candidates a fair chance. Whatever my candidate says is great. Whatever the candidates from the other party say is bad. Or in many cases, people are one issue people. They have their one pet issue, and if the candidate agrees or disagrees with them on that issue, then they are either totally opposed or totally not opposed. But my view is that to evaluate someone like a president overall, given the wide range of things on that person's agenda, something more analytically useful is necessary. So I think one thing to do is to start off by making a point that I'm going to pay attention to and do the research on: what are this person's ideas? What is the person's actual political philosophy, including his or her views on morality, on religion, on politics, on economy, on the wide range of issues? What does this person believe, as best that I can tell? And in the case of Javier Milei, it seemed like he was substantially libertarian on those, but he also had a significant minority number of conservative positions. Then to make a point of keeping track of the actions that the person engages in. And this involves following the news and making notes on he did this, he did this, he did this, he did not do this, and so forth. So you have the list as complete as you can make it. And then when one notices the actions that someone like a president does, it's of course that he, as the president, bears the ultimate responsibility for those. But at the same time, one needs to be aware that some of the actions that he engages in, he bears the responsibility for those alone. Sometimes they are the actions of ministers in his party. And in many cases, ministers are part of a coalition, and the president, while having sort of veto power in most cases, often does not have total say. And so, how much responsibility does the minister or the president bear for the particular issue? How much of it is coming, so to speak, from the coalition, and how much of it is coming from the president? And then also, often at one time, one inherits, right, a given situation, and there are going to be actions, both of which are possible to you, and both of which involve benefits and costs at the same time. And as much as possible, when evaluating those actions, to be aware of those cost benefit calculations. That the person often will say, yes, I'm aware that I'm causing pain in this respect, but my judgment is that this benefit outweighs those pains. So trying to read that person's mind as much as one is possible in evaluating initially the or putting the things on the list. I like to on my computer make a good and bad table. It's simple. The things that I think are good, things that I think are bad, and actually starting to place things, his ideas on the good and the bad side, the actions on the good side, on the bad side. When one has a list of good and bad things, to get more nuanced, to then say, well, which of these things, say, that I disagree with or I think are worrisome, are more important, and which of them are less important. So when I am making a judgment call about the things that are good and the things that are bad, making sure that I'm going to be focusing first on the most important things. So in this case of Argentina, we know that Javier Milei has a lot of views on the economy. He also has some views on immigration, on abortion, on religion, and so forth. But I wouldn't weight all of those equally in importance, both for good or bad. Some of them are more important, some of them are less important. So be attentive to and put one's own weightings on those things. Then one have done all of those things, then you have a big overall judgment call of weighting what you have on the overall good list and on the overall bad list to come up with an overall assessment. So what I'm going to do then is start to talk through some of those things. Now, my judgment call is that there are lots of issues facing Argentina and facing any president at any time. But for Milei's presidency, the three most important issues are the economy, and the economy. So those ones, in my thinking, get the hugest amount of weighting. There are lots of things that I know I would disagree with Javier Milei on various foreign policy and social issues and so on, but they are much further down the list. So then we say, I'm going to pay a special attention to what Milei is doing with respect to economic issues. Now, I'm not a professional economist. I know enough to talk some of the talk and be a little bit dangerous, but inflation is a terrible issue. When I started to go to Argentina, first time was in 2010. The peso was trading at the official rate at 16 pesos to the dollar. By the time we got to 2023, it was well over 1,000 pesos to the dollar on the black market. And that's over 10 years. So that's terrible, terrible inflation, just destroying many people's savings and those on fixed incomes and other kinds of dislocations as well. The amount of spending that goes on in the government. We in North America, I'm from Canada and America and Europe, we complain about the amount of fat and the amount of, even if we agree that something's a legitimate government function, right, or not, a lot of it is just wasteful and ridiculous. But we have nothing on the Argentinians. Take whatever your worst complaints are about the American or the Canadian government bloat, and multiply it by a factor of 4, 5, or 6, and then you are in the range of the problem in Argentina. So the amount of number of people on the payroll, so to speak, who should not be on the payroll, setting aside or nesting that within another judgment call about which things the government should be doing or should not be doing in the first place. Recognizing that the amount of tax revenue in Argentina has been woefully inadequate to pay for all of the government spending, so it's running deficits. And so tackling the deficit, again, a size of the economy, worse problem for Argentina than the richer countries in Europe and North America. The amount of taxes paid by Argentinians. One of my economist professors' friends in Argentina had done a serious calculation of this and said that if you were in business and you paid legally every tax that you were supposed to pay, you would pay 120 something percent of your income. That is to say, you only survive in business by cheating on your taxes, by hiding income. And of course, you can't get away with everything, but you pay nonetheless a huge amount of taxes, and that is, for all kinds of obvious reasons, a problem. A number of things that you are not allowed to do, the amount of regulations that are just obstacles or outright prohibitions. So deregulation is another important thing to pay attention to. To the extent that we think some things can be better done in the private sector than in the government sector, the issue of privatizing for economic gain is another one. One of the major government expenses is the number of bureaucrats on the payroll, and is the president committed to payroll deduction, including people in the legislature and the president themselves? And presidents and people in the legislature are notorious politicians around the world for giving themselves lots of perks that the public is not aware of them, giving themselves lots of pay raises. And so that one is an important bellwether. So that's not an exhaustive list, but those are the things that one would make a list of explicitly and start to make notes on in order to do a serious assessment. So I'll just mention a few things that I have that struck me. And I've got these are just a few. But it has struck me that over the course of the 6 months that Javier Milei has been in power, he has succeeded in steadily reducing inflation rate. He inherited a 300% inflation rate at the end of December, shading into January of this year. That went down steadily. The latest number we saw was for May of 2024. That was 4%. So from 300% inflation rate to 4% inflation rate in 6 months. That's a significant factor. For 5 months running, January through May, there has been now a budget surplus in the Argentinian government. He has fired tens of thousands of bureaucrats with more in the offing. And that is the 70,000 was the latest estimate that I saw. But that is then 70,000 people who probably were not adding value to the economy or adding value to the country. They are now off the payroll. They will get jobs in the private sector where most likely, if they can get a job in the private sector, they're actually going to be doing something value adding to the economy. So that's a win for the economy as a whole, but it's certainly a win for the government budget. A small thing, but Milei has frequently made a point of flying coach when he travels around the country. And this is partly a matter of political theater to show that he is a man of the people, but it's a serious amount of political theater because he is in effect showing that I'm not going to hide myself away from the people. And I'm not going to fly around in a government jet and enjoy all kinds of perks and so forth, even though I could with the power that I have. I'm going to take seriously staying in contact with the people and cutting expenses where it is possible. With respect to the issue of the internal coalition and internal divisiveness among people who are in the government, he has fired a couple of ministers. One of them for leaking information inappropriately. One way of sabotaging the operations of government is not keeping things that should be secret. secret so that the political enemies know what's going on and they can do various kinds of damages. For being obstructionist, things that Millay and the cabinet had decided that we were going to do, going in slow motion or putting up various other obstacles to make sure that that thing did not happen. When Millay became aware of that, firing that cabinet minister, again saying, signaling that I am going to deal with the problems or it's significant. Another was that the government had decided early in the presidency that they were going to freeze the pay for all government officials, and particularly senior government officials. There had been a kind of an automatic pay raise for senior government officials put into place by previous administrations. And that was allowed by one of the cabinet ministers to go through. And when that did go through, Millay made a point again of firing that cabinet minister. You knew better. You should have stopped that. And so making it clear that he's not just talking the talk, so to speak. A more significant thing was a number of things that had been done over the course of January through May, but there was a kind of an omnibus bill of 238 provisions that got through the Senate very close vote in May with so a huge number of economic reforms are now more than likely going to go forward. So it's not just a reform here and there. It's a huge number. We're talking of hundreds of things that have been thought out and are going to be put through. Some of them that grabbed my attention, I'll just give some anecdotes, some small examples here. One is making serious the point about taxes and fiscal transparency to the consumer. So right now, what had happened actually up until now in Argentina was that if you bought something, you did not know how much the purchase price was going to the business and how much of the purchase price was taxes. And there had been a law passed by previous governments in Argentina that made it illegal for businesses to let consumers know how much of the purchase price was taxes and how much of it was actually going to the business. And that was a way, since taxes were so high, of hiding just how much of taxation is going to the government. And anytime there's a tax or a price increase or things seem expensive and consumers are complaining, that of course they're going to direct their ire toward the business and not, in many cases, toward the government where the significant prices are. So that old law was overturned, and it is now legal for businesses to say, here is the price of the good, and to make clear and explicit and transparent how much of the purchase price is taxation. And I think this is significant for economic education of the consumers, but also for political education for consumers so they know exactly what is going on there. Another one with respect to taxes that I think was important, the property transfer tax. Anytime there was a real estate transaction from one person to another, there was an additional 1.5% tax that was paid. And so this was a significant source of revenue for the government. That was a tax that was eliminated. Therefore, it's going to have huge impact for people who want to buy homes, cost of rental properties. And there has been a housing shortage, and as in many places in the world, very difficult for people to purchase homes. So this is a at least immediately at a 1.5% solution toward that particular problem. Now, there's lots more that can be said in there, but what I want to do is move on from this issue of what has Milei done with respect to economic issues to talk about what I think is perhaps a more important long-term impact that Milei is having, and that is not as a politician doing various sorts of reforms, but Javier Milei as an educator of economics. Many politicians, of course, don't know very much about economics. They don't talk about it. When they do talk about the economic situation, they talk briefly about it, they lie about it, they divert, and so forth. One of the things that is very important about Millay is that he is and has been an economics professor for many years. He knows his material very well, and he likes talking about it and explaining it. So Argentina is a country in which there is huge amounts of economic ignorance. That's true, of course, of many countries around the world. But if Argentina is going to be successful as any sort of a democratic, Republican mass participation in the political process, it needs to have a citizenry that knows basic economics. And so if Javier Milei manages to stay in power for 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, we don't know. Will he get re-educated or not? The fact that he takes time in his speeches when he's talking as the president to talk about economic matters, to explain what he is doing, the problems that he has inherited, the rationale for the explanation. He is giving people knowledge that will then inform them as they think about their own economic circumstances, their business circumstances, and as they vote for the rest of their lives in Argentina Argentinian elections. And that, I think, is going to be a huge, long-lasting impact of Javier Milei. Javier Milei, not necessarily as president, but Javier Milei as president of, sorry, as a professor of economics who happens to be president. That's going to be hugely important, a huge value for the Argentinian economy. Now, I'm a professor of philosophy, and I want to just throw out this a hypothesis, but I think perhaps the more and most important thing that Javier Milei is doing, whether we think he is successful in this 100% or not, and that is that Javier Milei is also a moral professor or a professor of morality. And one of the hugely refreshing things about Milei has been his honesty. Now, obviously, honesty comes out in Milei in crude, negative form fairly frequently. But the fact that he is willing to use moral language front and center to say what is good, what is bad, and to say that it matters that these things are good and bad is crucially important for the psychological and moral political health of Argentina. One of the big problems that Argentinian culture has, especially its political culture, is a kind of amoralism, the expectation that, yeah, we know everybody is corrupt in politics. Yeah, we know all of the connected businessmen are corrupt in politics, but what are we going to do about it? That's life. That's politics. We accept it. That's business as normal. And, if I had the chance in business or if I got elected to politics, I would probably do the same sort of thing, and pat myself on the back for being able to scam the economy out and the government out of a certain amount of money. That kind of amoral, shading into immoral culture is death to a politics, it's death to a country. Argentina has been suffering from it for generations. So to have a president who comes along and says, look, corruption is immoral, and we are not going to tolerate it, to put that issue out there front and center. We are not going to engage in double standards, one set of standards that we expect the populace to engage in, and a different set of standards for politicians. The faking of economic numbers, the outright lying about where the funds are coming from, where the funds are going, what the impact of various policies is going to be. We are not going to tolerate any of that. The idea that I am a politician, I made as a candidate certain promises. Well, it's often that all of us will say around the world, oh, yeah, politicians will just blow smoke until they get elected, but they will not follow through. The fact that Milei has said, this is what I believe, this is what I'm going to do if I am elected, and he is doing those things. Again, perhaps not perfectly, but his record is much stronger and his commitment. So that honesty plus the integrity in action, absolutely crucial to the moral health of the culture. I've been impressed with the fact that he has been using moral language, undermining the socialists, and there's a huge number of them in Argentina, the huge number of Peronists, and I don't know how much we know about Argentinian politics, but the Peronist party was like 99% a fascist policy party formed in the 1920s, directly inspired by Mussolini's fascism in Italy. and putting in practice fascist policies over the decades. Of course, it became corrupted and institutionalized and watered down in some respects. But the fact that Milei is saying, look, that is fascism, that is bad, that is socialism, that is bad, that is cronyism, that is evil. And using this language strongly in identifying who the bad guys are is refreshing and important. At the same time, on the emphasizing the positive, he uses the language of saying that businessmen are heroes for creating value, wanting to trade with other people, wanting to enrich the economy, and of course, become wealthy themselves. That is a virtue. A heroic virtue, particularly in a corrupted economy such as Argentina. So, identifying business, if it's done well and morally, as a great moral beacon to be held up high and striven for. That entrepreneurs also are noble people, coming up with their own vision, having been the self-starters, starting all of the businesses that are going to grow and be successful. That is a heroic, noble practice to engage in. So identifying in moral terms the positive as well. And also the theme with respect to Argentina, which has been depressed political culture for decades, to say that Argentina should be successful. We've got natural resources. We've got huge amount of political capital. We have what it takes once again to be among the richest countries in the world, giving Argentinians a positive goal to strive for. It's not just going to be corrupt politics and business as usual, and we're just going to limp along. We can be awesome and giving particularly young people a positive message about where Argentina possibly can go. And I think all of that is hugely important. So that's then 3 points: his actual actions with respect to economics, his being a professor of economics and an educator, but then also this is not quite the right title, but a professor of moral philosophy or moral culture, and making many strong points. All of those things I think are important to evaluating Milei's presidency. So to come back to the initial concerns and questions that we had about Milei 6 months ago, is he committed and not just a guy who wants power and is a dilettante? No, I think the answer to that clearly is he is committed. He's putting in the hours, he's putting in the effort, he is doing everything that he can to make his presidency mean something. With respect to his character and his style, the wild and crazy Milei that we were all aware of before, I think he has muted and moderated that significantly, at least in what I have seen over the 6 months. So I think he is becoming more and more presidential and is growing into that role. So I think he's taking seriously what it is to have presidential character and style. Still some question marks there. He's a very passionate man, and he does have the years of certain character style. So it's only 6 months, but I'm more encouraged now on that point than I was 6 months ago. Is he able to overcome the political opposition, both internal and external? I don't. He has not achieved everything that he has wanted, but I think in terms of what he has accomplished and been able to get done in 6 months has been very impressive, despite internal opposition and despite more formidable external opposition. So I don't know exactly how much one could have gotten done in 6 months, but it does strike me that he has gotten significant amounts of it. And then that's the thing that perhaps is the most surprising to me. I did not expect him to be able to accomplish as much in 6 months as he has accomplished in that 6 months. Now, still, we're in the honeymoon phase. This is still relatively early in the presidency. There's a lot of slogging ahead. So, where we will be in 6 months, 1 year, 2 years from now, I don't know. But he has proven to be, I think, effective as a politician, given his lack of track record, surprisingly so. Now, I want to make two more points, and these are kind of new things that are possible concerns for us to pay attention to as we keep an eye on Milei and Argentina for the coming months and years. One is that in this omnibus bill of 238 items, and also along the way, there has been an increase in the number of emergency powers granted to the office of the president. And this is already in the case of the presidency of Argentina rather, already having lots and lots of powers, already a very strong executive function. So the argument here has been Argentina is in a terrible state in various respects, and so the president needs to have powers that are going to jumpstart the normal legislative and perhaps judicial process to be able to unilaterally make certain things happen. And I want to say that obviously the under argument for that is sometimes there are emergencies, and so having your executives have emergency power makes, of course, sense. But this is always a worry. Anytime there's an increase in the amount of power, particularly emergency power among the executives, and especially in a Latin American country. So I would flag this as something to pay close attention to over the course of the next year or so. One ameliorating thing with respect to the emergency powers is that they do have a sunset clause attached to them. So that's built into the legislature. So it's not just that the president gets the emergency powers until the legislature takes them away or the judiciary takes them away. He has these emergency powers for a certain amount of time, and then they will be automatically retired. And that's a good thing. But nonetheless, we do also know that sunsets can be ignored. And so there's still a big concern there. So that's one that I would like to flag. And the other thing I would like to flag before I close is there has been a significant amount of normal political opposition. It's the people among the electorate who disagree with Milei, and they make their voices heard. And normal among people in the legislature and in the bureaucracy who disagree with Milei, and they have not used the political power that they have. All of that is normal part of Democratic and Republican Party. But there is a significant amount of gang activity in Argentina, more so than in other countries. And a significant amount of organized crime in Argentina, again, perhaps more. And they are also threatened in various ways by the Milei presidency. In some cases, their corruption involved, getting sweetheart deals with respect to the government and so on. So they have, in many cases, resorted to increases of violence in various sorts in order to exert their political opposition. And this is an ordinary problem in one respect, and governments do need legitimately to have police power and military power to deal with some of these gangs and some of the organized crimes, criminals rather, particularly when they are crossing international borders. So one thing that I am a little concerned about, though, is that Milei is increasing naturally the police response and the military response, but he also has signaled an interest in what Bukele is doing in El Salvador, because El Salvador, another Central American country, has had terrible gang issues and criminal organization issues, and it has quite famously, over the course of the past year, engaged in crackdowns with respect to that. And in one respect, it has been enormously successful in arresting and detaining and putting on trial. In some cases, people have died. And so the organized gang and organized crime problem is much less now in El Salvador than it certainly was a year ago. But there's a problem here in that the El Salvador case is involving a lot of setting aside of ordinary rule of law and the rights of citizens to due process, habeas corpus, and so forth. So there has been a serious overstepping of the mark in El Salvador in order to achieve these ends. So, to the extent that Milei has signaled, I think he sent one of his ministers to El Salvador to study what has happened in El Salvador to see what can be adapted to the Argentinian case. To the extent that dealing with the problems in Argentina would involve some of the methods that have been used in El Salvador, I think that's a serious problem and a serious worry for us to pay attention to. All right, so just a one sentence conclusion. I would say Malay overall, I have some questions, has had an excellent 6 months, first 6 months. So I hope to be back in 1 year to do a follow-up, see how things are going then. So let's turn things open to discussion and Q&A.
All right. Thank you for that, Stephen. Definitely a lot that was covered there. And I've been keeping an eye on all of the questions that have been in the comment section. So we'll try to work through them here in the next sort of 20 minutes or so that we have left. So jumping in with the first question here comes from Rick Robin. And you've partially answered this already, but this goes a bit more detail. He asked, how has Malay's experiment worked out for the Argentine people? And will it be a model for other countries? And then his follow-up to that is, how has Malay been dealing with foreign relations?
So that's actually two questions, one about Argentina in particular, and then the foreign relations issue. I think there is a lot of optimism among the people and a lot of pain among the people. When the last time I was down there in Argentina, I was down there in December, January, and again in March, April, and there were a significant number of disruptions, some internal to the government, various sorts of government services that had been provided. For example, Malay said, we're not going to subsidize, say, this bus service anymore. And what that then meant was that many of the bus companies that were getting bus subsidies then basically held their finger up to Malay and says, okay, so therefore we're just going to cut services and we're going to blame Malay for it. And so that meant a lot of people went without transportation for a certain number of days. But even aside from that that obstructionist kind of pain, there is the very real pain that has to happen anytime you are getting out of an economic predicament that you have gotten yourself into. So and Malay, to my knowledge, has been extraordinarily upfront about this. You know, he's saying, look, we're going to do this, and this is going to hurt for 6 months. It's going to hurt for a year. All of these people who are getting subsidies, right? Well, you know, we take the subsidy away, and it's been a 20% subsidy. That means that you have to come up with 20% somehow. And 20% for people who are already close to the line in a relatively poorer country like Argentina, that's an economically painful thing. All of the people who were on the government payroll in various respects, if you don't get a job, well, that's painful. Or you don't have a job now, you have to find another job. That is painful, and so forth. So the point, though, has been, just to make the analogy, if you have been living large on your credit card for a certain number of years, and you get religion, so to speak, with respect to how you're going to responsibly use your credit card, it's going to hurt psychologically, and you are going to cut back on your lifestyle for a certain amount of that. So multiply that by 20 million. That's going to happen in Argentina. So yeah, so there is a lot of pain, but I think people have gotten the message, and this is partly Malaya's economic educator, that this is a necessary pain that we're going to have to go through, but they are open to believing that with the economy being rebuilt, that we can get past this pain and actually be better off in 1 year, 2 years, 5 years, or whatever. So the other question then was about foreign relations. There, I've been tracking much less. I know that he's done some international speeches at WEF in Switzerland. He was up in the United States a couple of times and gave some major talks there as well. And I know that that with respect to IMF and all of the international banking and economic organizations, many of them carrying credit or carrying the debt rather that Argentina has, a lot of serious conversations that are above my economic pay grade. I don't know enough to be able to comment on those, but I do think that the fact that he's having the conversations and that from what I've read, he's been very forthright about being a serious economist and a serious free market economist, all of that's going to go well.
Okay, great. The next question that has come in, it's a little bit of a long one, so let me know if you want me to reread it. This is from Hope Malkin asking about the president's intention to, he's, well, what it says is I have recently read The President's Intention to Court Investment and Development in AI. This, of course, means Silicon Valley. I would like to know how he can square this intention with the reality of big tech's implementation of censorship in this country, and the bigger issue of AI as the linchpin of surveillance, of the surveillance state.
Well, I first want to just generalize that. I think the first thing is that Argentina desperately needs foreign investment. So one thing is to home grow your own capital, and Argentina can do that with, it's got a lot of human capital, a lot of natural resources, but that's a longer process. A way of short-circuiting that process is convincing foreign businesses that have millions and billions of dollars and expertise at their disposal to come into Argentina in order to invest and then speed up that process. So I know that they are actively courting foreign investment. One part of the 238 item omnibus bill was to offer generous tax credits to foreign investors. That then is to say, instead of saying paying 80% taxes, you'll only be paying 40% taxes or 30% or whatever the number is going to be. And I think that's essential to have a more normalized tax rate if you're going to attract foreign investors. Foreign investors are not going to invest in Argentina if they're paying 80% taxes or 60% taxes if they can invest in Canada and pay 30 or 40% taxes. So the tax differential is going to be important. The more important thing, though, there is whether the foreign investors will believe not only Malay in particular, but Argentina in general. Latin America in general has a terrible record of inviting foreign investors to invest billions of dollars, and once the infrastructure is in place, to then just nationalize it. And sometimes this is done honestly by one administration that attracted the foreign capital and the infrastructure, but then they are out and a new administration comes in that's much more socialistic or communistic, and it just goes ahead and expropriates it. So part of it then is they have to convince the foreign investors that whatever billions they invest is going to be safe for 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, whatever the time horizon is going to be. Now, come to AI in particular, this again, that's a narrow sector. But I do think one of the interesting things about Argentina is that relative to other Latin American nations, it has a more educated population. I've seen statistics that Buenos Aires has more bookstores per capita than any other city in the world, and it has had for some generations. So it's a relatively more literate population, and education is taken relatively seriously in higher education. And so Argentina has largely suffered the problem of a brain drain, so lots of top Argentinians who are ambitious end up making their fortunes and successful careers outside of Argentina. So it is natural for a country like Argentina to say that if one of our human capital assets is very smart people with an education, for them that for then us to emphasize high tech, and AI is the hottest and sexiest and perhaps most promising part of high tech in this area. So Argentina wants to be involved in all of that. And so that would then be a judgment call. Again, I'm a philosopher. I'm not having a seat at that table in order to make that particular judgment. But then the tail end of that question was to say, yeah, well, of course, AI and any kind of technology can be abused. So to the extent that there are surveillance issues and then we're bringing in AI, and if it Argentina ends up being a surveillance state down the road, that would be a net negative. So that would be a concern. But I think that's a normal to everyone in the world concern right now. That's not a unique Argentinian problem. So I'll stop there.
Okay. Next question comes in from Arno. He asks, while Milei has had some success, there are other leaders, Meloni in Italy, Poland and Bulgaria with different levels of libertarian versus conservative mix and success. Can we draw any larger conclusions?
I'm sure someone can, but I can't, just because I have better knowledge of what's going on in Argentina, you know, for various reasons. And I don't think I have any particular expertise with respect to Italy. I've not been following that at near the same level. But I think I have more concerns about Italy. I have more concerns about Poland. Let me say, I spent time in Poland as a visiting professor a couple of times, so I have better knowledge there. And while I'm very impressed with how Poland has, over the course of the last generation, pulled itself out of the malaise of communism, it's a very impressive case study. At the same time, there are some legitimate concerns about the degree to which it's going in a more conservative slash authoritarian direction as well. So, with that, though, I'm going to have to stop, just because I am not enough of a political scientist to say I have done the expert level study of what's going on in Poland, Italy, and Argentina, and I can do a point by point compare and contrast to come up with the kind of overall conclusion the question is asking for.
Fair enough. Another question comes in here from Scott asking, what lessons of Malay can pro-liberty politicians here in the US incorporate?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. I'd say one lesson is that it can be done. I think many people who are liberty friendly in a principled way in the United States are naturally discouraged that both the Republican parties and the Democrat Party are very far from libertarian or objectivist, or even classically liberal politics. And that the Libertarian Party, not that I've paid much attention over the years, but seems to be a disappointment in a lot of respects. So there's a tendency to give up and say it's impossible. So the fact that there are countries where people who have genuinely liberal slash libertarian views can be successful politically and can play the game, like that should be encouraging. Immediately, then, to say one of the other lessons is that seems to be packaged with the idea that it's not only that you have to have someone who is a principled liberty person who's willing to go into politics and keep his liberty soul intact, so to speak, not be corrupted. But it does seem to be the case that things have to get really, really bad before, in a democratic slash Republican context, enough people are willing to vote for you. So I think one of the sectors, for example, that seems to be finally turning around is the education sector, say, in North America. But it has taken decades of underperformance and just ideological nastiness in the education sector for millions and millions of people in America, and to a lesser extent in Canada, to finally say enough is enough. We're going to try to seriously reform education. We're going to do all kinds of entrepreneurial outside of the government sector activities to do education seriously. So education really had to hit rock bottom for us to start taking it seriously. So using that just as one example, one of the lessons seems to be that we have our work cut out for us before the general populace is in a position to vote for liberal libertarian policies, freedom policies on their own merits, and not just, well, we tried everything else and that was a disaster, so I guess we might as well try liberty.
Great. So I've seen a number of questions thrown through Zoom and elsewhere already touching on something you've covered about pushback to hit what he's trying to do, either from other people in government or from how he's doing with the citizenry. But since there's so many questions about that, maybe you could go into a bit more detail. Maybe what is the biggest obstacle that Milei is going to face, maybe from either other political groups in Argentina or just from the general populace in regards to his policies? What do you think is going to be the biggest challenge for him moving forward?
Well, so if you're just focusing on domestic Argentinian politics, not anything external, then there's the electorate, and so there's the question of, is he going to continue to make the case that we're going through a painful process, but we are rebuilding, and that by the time the next election comes around, an election season 3, 4 years from now, a significant number of the population is still with him. They've been able to endure the shock of transition. Their lives are economically better off than they were, and so on. So that's one, and I think that's going to be an open question. I'm cautiously optimistic on that one. The second one is the internal coalition of liberals of various sorts, libertarians of various sorts, conservatives of various sorts. The coalition government that Milei put together, my sense is, this is not a super informed opinion, that he now has a working team, that he is accepted as the leader, and that they are going to be more or less internally functional. That the amount of backstabbing and obstructionism will be kind of normal level backstabbing and obstructionism inside the coalition, and that they should be able to go forward. So that leaves the third group, which I think is going to be the most formidable, and that is the people who are politically and ideologically opposed to any sort of liberal libertarian approach, and to Milei's government in particular. So that's going to be the significant number of people in the Congress, in the general legislature, and among the Senate, who, no matter what, are going to be opposed to Milei personally, to the party, and they will just do whatever they can in order to block. Now, he's not going to change their minds, so then it's going to be a matter of politicking, and in some cases, compromising and horse trading, in order to deal with them. And then allied with them are going to be two more subgroups there, the people in the bureaucracy. A significant number of them have been let go. So the ones who remain in the bureaucracy, probably they will still, some of them, be obstructionist because they disagree, but they are probably going to be more quietly obstructionist because they know that Milei now is serious, and he has no compunction about firing them if he gets any whiff that they are not. They're not with with the program. The more serious, longer term constituent outside of Milei's group is going to be the intellectuals, though, the people in the media, the newspaper, and they are quite monolithically opposed, and that's a significant force on public opinion. And then among the professors and the professional intellectuals in other organizations, they are still, even more so than what we are used to in North America, opposed to any sort of liberal libertarianism. So I think that battle of ideas is also, in a longer term, going to be important. Whether he can win that one, I don't think he can win that one. It's not going to be his job to win that one over the course of the next 3 or 4 years. Those sorts of intellectual arguments, that debate goes much more slowly. That's a generational thing. So he's going to need much, a lot of allies among the think tanks and what, those people who are currently ideologically in the minority position in Argentina and fellow countries. So short term, I think his party or his coalition is with him. You're not going to change the minds of the politicians who are opposed to them. I think the bureaucracy is just going to go along, some of them rather sullenly, but some of them will be appointed by the new government and will go along willingly. Intellectual public opinion is the longer game. That's probably the most important one for Argentina 10, 20 years from now.
Okay, great. Now we're coming down to the last 3 minutes or so before we wrap up. There's a lot more questions, so I apologize to everyone who we're not going to get to all of them today. But to sort of cap things off, a question that is pretty appropriate for this audience, I think. This comes from Jacoby on Instagram. He asks, how should objectivists contend with Millet's religious grounding?
Well, I don't know very much about his religious grounding. I know that he converted to Judaism, and but beyond that, I don't know how much that's a matter of personal faith that is something separate from his political views, from his economic views. I understand that he understands. From my limited personal interactions with him, but from also the stuff that I have read from him, that he is, a savvy enough politician to know that, Judaism is a minority religion, and so his job is not at all to try to convert people to Judaism. That's not a part of Judaism anywhere. Anyways, it's not an evangelistic religion. We have to convert the masses and get everybody. And I don't think I see any signs that he is seeing any his personal religious views as important to the kinds of policies that he's going to be focusing on, particularly with respect to economics over the next few years. So the only possible important issue is going to be, say, the abortion issue. Where Judaism, there are various strands of Judaism, and they have different takes on the abortion issue. But some of the more conservative forms of Judaism are anti-abortion, and some of the members of Millet's coalition government are of a more conservative ideological outlook, and for some of them, abortion is a much more important issue than economic issues and so on. So some of his kind of important people inside the coalition want to elevate that issue. But to my sense of the situation, I think that's the only place that I know of where Millet's rather personal religious views might get some traction in the next few years.
Okay, very good. And with that, we've reached the top of the hour. So, big round of applause for Stephen for doing that very sort of comprehensive overview of what Millet's went up to and getting into the nitty-gritty details. So, thank you so much for this, Stephen. And I want to thank everyone who joined us today. If you enjoyed this video or any of the other content we produce here at the Atlas Society, please consider making a tax-deductible donation at theatlassociety.org /donate. And be sure to join us next week. Our CEO, Jennifer Grossman, will be back, and she will be interviewing best-selling author Amber Smith about her latest book, Unfit to Fight: How Woke Policies Are Destroying Our Military. Thanks again, Stephen. Have a wonderful night.
Thanks, Lawrence. Bye for now.